it, nor interpret it in abstract constructs and concepts, whose total equation, because for the Homo theoreticus, the total equation of the universe is, it is knowable. Or if the universe were not knowable, comprehensible, there would be actually a gesture of resignation on the part of the scientist or the Homo theoreticus. The equation, the total equation of the Homo religiosus, says existence is a paradoxical affair, a mysterium magnum, which inspires a man awe and tremor. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, in order to arrive at such an absurd equation, or if I may use Kierkegaard's expression, to perform the movement of resignation, which is basic for the Homo religiosus, Homo religiosus must resign. From time to time, in order to perform the act or the movement of complete resignation, the Homo religiosus must explore every nook and corner of reality, examine, search every aspect of being, and try to interpret even the minutest process in reality. Because the act of resignation on the part of the Homo religiosus is not to be equated with the naivete of the uninitiated, ignorant person who denies the worth of knowledge because he doesn't know anything. Not to be equated. Whoever the Homo religiosus is, he must not be an ignorant person, nor must he be an arrogant person. Ignorance and arrogance are certain traits which are completely, are strange to the religious experience, incommensurate with the religious awareness. This skepticism which flows from an arrogant attitude is alien to the Homo religiosus. The act of resignation on the part of the Homo religiosus is rather to be compared with the skepsis of the Ecclesiastes or the despair of Faust by Goethe, who because of having attained great intellectual heights, because of their incessant drinking from the fountainhead of wisdom, and their mastery of the cognitive gesture, and their insatiable curiosity, have arrived at the conclusion that being is an insoluble equation. But it is a resignation which follows knowledge and completes the act of knowing, not an act of resignation which precludes knowledge. Because to resign before one knows is not resignation. This is arrogance and ignorance. Of course, only the mathematician can prove that certain equations are insoluble. The person who is not initiated in mathematics cannot prove that. And the Homo religiosus is the mathematician who tries to prove, who feels, the total equation of reality is an insoluble one, perhaps a great mystery. But he is a man of knowledge. He is an intellectual. He is driven by the so-called, if I may use a Kantian expression, the metaphysical impulse. He wants to know. Not only wants to act, not only he feels differently, he wants to know. And of course, the Homo religiosus knows of and is concerned with and is guided by an by existential purposes which surpass the boundary lines of finitude, True. He's also in another respect. He is different from the scientist. The scientist studies only reality, which is bounded in by finitude, by the frames of reference of time and space. However, the homo religiosus knows of another existence. I wouldn't say another existence, because this would sound a little too theological, but of an existence which transcends the boundaries of finitude. And the boundaries of finitude which is conditioned by temporality. Yet, irrespective of the ultimate end which religion pursues, and which is above and outside the worldly ambitions and aspirations of the homo theoreticus, irrespective of that, the drama of religion unfolds only within the confines of our natural orders. It means within the confines of this worldliness. Right here and now, and this is basically Jewish, right here and now, in a world of sound and color, of sensuous complexities, of change and development, of mechanical motion and unalterable processes, the homo man has his rendezvous with infinity, with God. In order to meet God, one does not have to transcend this world. Although he knows of a higher existence, but meeting God, and this is basically Jewish, perhaps Christianity disagrees. I mean, I would say medieval Christianity. In this respect, will come later. This point will return. This point, the Jewish opinion was, I mean, Jews always said, Judaism, that one meets God right here and now, within the confines of time and space. Here and now, in the midst of the events, of a world of events and things, of mechanical orders, man rises to great heights and meets his creator, and he also falls into a bottomless abyss of sin and actually inferior existence. Right here and now, he rebels against God and his authority, which he accepted prior to his rebellion, and right here and now, he returns to God meekly and humbly, like a child who apologizes to his father, against whom he rebelled a while ago. But it's in the right here and now reality. Right here and now, man struggles with absurdity and insensateness and tries to infuse meaning into something unknown, which we call existence. If, of course, gentlemen, the theater of religious activities, of religious self-expression and self-realization is to be found here in our sensuous world, then understanding of and acquaintanceship with the latter, with this world, is a conditio sine qua non for the proper guiding, for the proper realization of our religious destiny. So it means what I wanted to say is that religion lays claims to knowledge, and this knowledge does not pertain to eternity or to some transcendental entities or to some spiritual beings, but religion wants to know this world, this corporeal, sensuous world, in all its manifestations, and in all its, so to say, at all its levels, like the scientist or the homo theoreticus. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, it is a truism that although the cognitive gesture of the homo religiosus is a comprehensive one, aiming at reality in its entirety, manifesting itself in a variety of orders, The homo religiosus is mainly concerned with the order of personal existence. Or, to be more exact, with himself.
Of course he wants to know the world, certainly.
No doubt about it. But he's more concerned with himself. Perhaps there is a distinction between the homo theoreticus and the homo religiosus. The homo theoreticus, until recently, was more concerned with the outside world, with the physical processes, with motion, since the days of Thales. He was more concerned with the organic matter, with the process of life, which is also, I mean, belongs into the outside world. He was less concerned with himself, the scientist, because simply if the scientist had been concerned with himself as much as he was concerned with the outside world, with dead matter and animate matter, then perhaps psychology and sociology, all the humanities, would have progressed much more. Because actually knowledge of man is a latecomer in the history of science. It's a newcomer, actually. All right. In history of philosophy, you know, Socrates said, what is man? But it was a different approach. It was not knowledge, theoretical knowledge. It was more a practical problem. What should man do in order to be happy? This was the general problem of the Greek philosophers. Not who is man, what is man, what is the existential experience, what kind of a being he is, what is his uniqueness, singularity, his station in the world, in the universe. I mean, he struggled with the outside world and struggled with himself. No, this was not a problem of Socrates, nor was it the problem of Aristotle or Plato, his master Plato, nor was it the problem of the Stoics and the Epicurean school. The problem was a practical one, a pragmatic one, a functional problem. How can man be happy? How can he attain eudaimony, or what they call it, pleasure, hedone? It's a practical problem. And the whole discussion about man in Greek philosophy, in the late antique, I mean, in the Greek philosophy, from Socrates and down. So it did not revolve about the metaphysic of man or theory of man. It was more revolving about the practical discipline of man. How can man be happy? It's a technological problem about man, not a theoretical problem. Then you know very well that technological problems cannot be solved unless you do basic research. And this was the trouble with the Greek philosophy. When it came, I mean, to the outside world, they were pure theoreticians. The pragmatic view absolutely did not mislead them at all. They wanted to understand for the sake of knowledge. Of course, you know, the idea of technology, it was alien to the Greek, completely alien, because the type of knowledge he was pursuing did not lend itself to technological application. However, when he came to man himself, he suddenly turned into a technician. Not who is man, what is man, but how should man act in order to be happy. And of course, the homo religiosus is concerned with man and has a double problem. Who is man? And also the Greek problem, the pragmatic problem. What shall a man do in order, I mean, to realize or to find self-fulfillment? Religion must possess intimate knowledge and understanding at all levels of the existential experience, or what you call self-awareness. Otherwise, the God-man relationship could remain an enigma to the homo religiosus. If he doesn't understand himself, how can he approach God? However universally true the aforementioned maxim is, that the homo religiosus is intellectual type and is particularly interested in self-knowledge, it is true. Various religions differ as to the manner in which they emphasize the above-mentioned cognitive aspects of the homo religiosus. Most religious systems, and I'm speaking, I know, very When I say most religion systems, I am referring to Occidental religion. I have very little knowledge of Oriental religion. I have no right to speak, not even to mention it. Occidental religion, I understand Christianity and Islam. I'm quite well acquainted with Christian scholastics. Most religious systems were more prone to the theological thinking and developed theosophic doctrines, focusing their attention upon transcendental reality. And they developed only latent religious anthropologies. I mean, to distinguish it from scientific anthropology, we call religious anthropology. When you say religious anthropology, it means the metaphysic of man, the interpretation of man, formulated in religious terms. Of course, for instance, take Christianity. They have a social philosophy, no doubt about it. I mean, Thomas Aquinas developed it. Quite an extensive social philosophy based upon natural law, lex naturalis or lex naturae. But however, it's funny, it's strange, they developed a social philosophy without inquiring into the essence of man. How can you develop a social philosophy before you inquire into man for himself? Regardless of all the controversies about the relationship of man for himself, man within the community, we'll come later to this problem, this controversy. Whether the community perceives the individual, or the individual perceives the community, I mean systematically, conceptually. But however, Thomas Aquinas was not concerned with the problem, who is man? He was concerned, what is society? And that is the reason why social philosophy is incomplete, because it lacks the basic, so to say, the basic premise, knowledge of man for himself, man in seclusion. Man communing not with the other self, but man communicating with himself. That only lately, I mean, Christian philosophy began to develop. And actually this aspect of religious anthropology, dealing with the individual. And of course, this is what we know, what's known to us, under the name or the title religious existentialism. Well, there are many books were written about religious existentialism. What it is, it means the philosophy of man interpreted to the clean terms of Christianity. That is exactly, more or less, if we want to simplify this equation. However, Judaism occupied a very unique, so to say, position in the world of religion. While other religions stressed the idea of God more than that of man, Judaism, in its intellectual pursuit, concentrated on man. And religious anthropology replaced in Judaism theology. We have always inquired into the essence of man, never into the essence of God. Hence, our world formula is quite paradoxical. It is theocentric, God-centric, theocentric. However, anthropo-oriented. We are orientated on man. We concentrate, so to say, more teleologically on God. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. Judaism maintains that as any other civilized religion. Because if it's not the beginning and the end of everything, there's no need for religion. I can never understand the religion becomes so modernized that the idea of God is eliminated. Not that the zeal of the fanatic, I mean, is that what makes me rebel against it, but it's a simple question. If this is religion, so there is no need to spend so much money on its institutions. We are theocentric, but anthropo-orientated. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. In him, the fullness of existence is realized, and all yearnings of man find fulfillment. No doubt about it. It's very important for the therapeutic aspects of religion. Yet God himself, creator of the world, out of whose pure, absolute, infinite being, finitude emerged, God himself remains to us Jews, Keil mistater b'shastra sevyein, Deus absconditus, a mysterium tremendum, a hidden God, inapproachable, unknowable, inexpressible, eluding the grasp of our concepts. And if you'll allow me, I want here to just to raise one dichotomy, to call your attention to one dichotomy, or rather to an antithesis in our religious experience. Our experience of God, the Judaic experience of God, of course, you'll find it in other religions as well. But particularly the Judaic experience of God is antithetic. Insofar, it contains an awareness of both, of endless remoteness and mystery on the one hand, and of intimate closeness and familiarity on the other hand. Don't ask me how is it possible, because basically Judaism, in its approach to God, did not operate with the Aristotelian two-valued logic, or with the famous principle of contradiction or the excluded middle. Aristotle said, if it is A, it cannot be the same time B. If it is B, it cannot be the same time A. It's either A or B. And if it's A or B, it cannot be something else. We Jews say, it's typical of our mentality. It can be A in the same time B. And not only it can be A at the same time B, it can be A and the same time B, and also something else than A and B. Ladies and gentlemen, modern physics, classical physics, operates with this. For instance, the theory of light is interpreted nowadays both in terms of waves and in terms of particles, although both theories are mutually exclusive. So apparently, actually, the modern advanced mathematics and advanced physics actually cannot operate simply. The Mesa phenomena does not lend itself to a two-valued logical interpretation. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle was thrown away by the scientists. But in the religious approach, it's certainly that we operate with antithetic ideas, concepts. On one hand, he is remote, on the other hand, he is close. In our encounter with God, we find ourselves many a time bewildered by the opposition of two experiential alternatives. First, as I said before, Deus absconditus, God who is hiding in the depths of infinity and eternity. And second, as the psalmist says, Karov Hashem lechol korav, the Lord is nigh unto all that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth and sincerity. He is both, he is nigh and remote, he is near and far away. This is the Jewish experience of God. On the one hand, we experience God as dwelling apart and beyond all dimensions of being, hidden in the remotest recesses of infinity, unapproachable and incomprehensible, abiding in concealment and in the shadows of transcendence. And the word, the Hebrew word kadosh, holy, whoever knows the etymological meaning of kadosh, knows that kadosh actually in Hebrew signifies separateness, difference, otherness, incommensurability, something which doesn't belong into this order, something mysterious. It signifies the withdrawal of God from me. On the other hand, The homo religiosus feels also the immediate presence of that. He is endless remoteness and also the immediate presence of God. Outside and within him, God is man's haven, if you will. His fortress, his habitation, where man reside. He experiences God as his companion, father, mother, friend. The words I'm quoting are taken from the Bible. The Bible is the book of the Judaic religious experience. Mother, friend, lover and beloved, both together, who caresses his head, bend under the load of existence, and whispers words of condolence and hope. He is the shepherd who cares for the helpless and the weak, and carries the young in his possession. It's a quotation from Isaiah. On the one hand, Deus absconditus, on the other hand, Deus revelatus, close to us. On the one hand, mysterium tremendum, magnum, distant, strange, and unknowable, inspiring dread and awe. On the other hand, Deus revelatus, involved in creation in every aspect of existence, addressing himself to us through every twinkle of the distant stars, through every budding tree, out of the stillness of a summer night, the cry of the infant and the innocent laughter of the child, through one's thoughts, feelings, strivings, and yearnings. And on the other hand, distant, incomprehensible, strange, far in infinity, in the recesses of infinity. He confronts us both as an adversary, as an antagonist, and as a friend, as a stranger, and as a father, as a familiar figure, if I may use this expression, and as a mysterious person. You know, Jacob, who was wrestling with the stranger, who was the stranger, if not the same God who spoke to him a night before. The experience is antithetic, it's dichotomous. It's mutually exclusive, but still, this antithesis and this dichotomy actually lends to the religious experience its uniqueness, greatness, and magnificence. But of course, we must realize, keep in mind, that while the individual homo religiosus may engage in a paradoxical experience, fraught with incommensurate aspects and incongruous things, oscillating between complete resignation and passionate, ecstatic joy, the community, the institutionalized religion, must organize its collective experience along coherent patterns and cannot afford to tolerate polarity within our religious awareness. What is good for the at an esoteric level is absolutely inoperative at a exoteric level. What is good for the few individuals, for the homines religiosi, for the great religious genius, is absolutely incomprehensible for the average person. So of course, therefore, if you will, for instance, study the history of religion, you'll find that some religions have emphasized the aspect of remoteness of God. In other religions, on the contrary, introduce God as familiar figure. Although the religious experience, the private religious experience of the homo religiosus, has both motives, the motive of remoteness and the motive of closeness as well. For instance, you'll take Christianity. Why was the concept of father-son introduced? Why is it? Why was this Trinitarian motif introduced in Christianity? Philosophically? Simply, whoever reads the literature of the fathers of the desert, of the fathers of the desert, or read the literature of Saint Augustine, his Confessions, the City of God, and so forth on, we will see that Christianity actually was torn by two motives. by the motive of closeness of God and remoteness of God, by the motive of Deus absconditus, the hidden God, and by the motive of Deus revelatus, the revealed God, the God who is close to me, who within me, who has intercourse with me, who is my companion, to whom I can address myself, I can pray, I can complain, I may rebel, I may engage in a dialogue. And the final result was that God Father is the remote one, and the Son is the one who was walking on earth, associating with people, speaking to them. That's why in Christianity, in Christian theology, you know very well, all prayers cannot be addressed to the Father unless we beseech the Son to mediate between us and the Father. Why? Because the Father is too remote for prayer. Prayer cannot reach him. There is no way for man to find access to God Father. That's why the access simply split divinity into two entities and introduce the Son. It means the God who is close to me. Judaism, a Unitarian religion, couldn't do that. So in Judaism, it is an antithesis, a dichotomy of closeness and remoteness. Yeah, the question is, what did Judaism do with the problem of its institutionalized religion? Judaism is also, it's a private experience, it's also an institutionalized religion. Yeah. Any religion must be institutionalized. I mean, because the word religion itself, I mean, indicates institutionalization. Institutionalized, conceptualized, made, so to say, available to the crowd. Because it cannot, you see, for instance, education. There were times when education was considered a privilege of the select few of the aristocratic society. In England had such a system. Actually, old Greece, I mean, actually believed in aristocracy. As education is concerned. You can say art. Eliot says that art is only a product of the class of leisure. Okay. But no one can say that religion should be, so to say, limited to the select few. For a simple reason. Because from our viewpoint, religion saves men, gives them salvation and redemption. And we think that everybody is entitled to salvation and redemption, not only the philosopher, but the simpleton as well, not only the aristocrat, but the slave as well. So you cannot turn the religious experience into an esoteric affair for the philosopher, for the inquiring mind, for the person who simply encounters God. Means and ways must be found in order to simplify the religious experience and to make it available and accessible to every person. And the dichotomous religious experience is an esoteric affair. Exoterically, the average person on the street cannot understand the dichotomy. It's either or. The principle of contradiction that Aristotle introduced into logic is simply common sense. It's either black or white. It cannot be between, or gray, I mean, all right. But what either black or either it's a square or it's round. What, or a circle, it cannot be both at the same time. So what did Judaism do? What motive was emphasized not in the private experience of God, the Judaic private experience? The Judaic private experience, as it was depicted and described in the Psalms, this is the greatest book on religious experience in general, I believe, and I'm never apologetic about it, but it's the greatest book in of the religious experience in general. Everybody agrees to it. As far as it's concerned, the psalmist was a religious genius, I mean, the real homo religiosus. In him you find psalms, the famous psalm, God is my shepherd, I shall not want. So how is God depicted, described there? Close, companion, my shepherd, I associate with him, I engage in a dialogue with him, I bend my tired head on his shoulder, and he whispers in the million words of hope to me. And the same psalmist, the next day, in the next chapter begins to say, where can I escape from you? Where can I find you? I have searched you everywhere. I found you nowhere. I came to your sanctuary, it's your temple. I thought I'll find you there, but you are not there. I searched in the woods. I didn't find your shadow. Who are you? On the one hand, he speaks of God as his companion, his shepherd. On the other hand, in the same breath, he says he can't find God, he doesn't know where he is. It's what we say, numen presence, numen absence. God is present and absent. He's right here and he's infinity. He's remote.
Here has been as much as we have of this philosophy lecture.
Imagine, gentlemen, if Israel would go communist. Imagine. And it's also possible. Everything is possible. Israel went communist. Imagine our lot here. You know what what the world would say to us. And Israel, a communist Israel would not be dangerous to society. Who cares? Two more million people coming. Poor. And actually people without security, safety. And here is a great empire of 600 million people communist. No one is blaming a Chinese man in America for a simple reason. Why the Chinese in America is either an American resident or an American citizen. He's not to be blamed for Mao Zedong, of course. Collective responsibility is a primitive way of thinking. This is the scapegoat psychology, to put all these things on the scapegoat, on this innocent goat. Yes, but somehow it works with regard to us. I don't know why it is so. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an anthropologist. It's hard for me to explain, but it's a fact. Mr. Scott.
Take the case of a communist. How many countries have communists been active in revolution, other than in China itself?
You mean who, the Chinaman?
China.
Overall Asia. China now is the greatest danger. Yeah. Russia is no danger now. China is communist. There is a communization of Asia. We didn't lose the war, the Cold War in Europe. We lost the Cold War in Asia because there is steady communization of Asia. And you'll see, I don't want to be a prophet of doom. I'm afraid that Asia will go communist, including India. Because there's no force which can resist communism in Asia. And still no one blames the Chinese.
The fact is this, that historically so far, people have attributed Jews with liberalism, with radicalism, and I think historically it has been true.
How many Jews were active in the liberal movement? I happen to know very well the Russian history. How many Jews here and there, during the revolution there were a few Jews, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Trotsky, all right, but there are more Russians. I mean, there is something which I cannot understand, yes.
Well, isn't there a story, maybe it's apocryphal, about your own father with relation to a Russian-Jewish revolutionary?
About my grandfather, yes.
Is that true?
No, it's true, it's a true story.
Right.
No, this is nothing to do. You know the story about my grandfather, about the rabbi in Buddha, the famous of time. The once revolutionary of the social revolutionaries, they believed in terror. Social democracy in Russia did not believe in terror. They thought to bring it about through an educational campaign in terror. So when the governor general of Warsaw, the district of Poland at that time was a part of Russia, was killed by a bomb, a boy from Brisk, from the town he was rabbi, was involved. And of course, it meant a court martial and death. My grandfather, whether he didn't believe in his guilt, or he believed in his guilt, but he thought still, for killing the governor general in Warsaw, a Jewish boy should not die on the gallows. Anyway, what his opinion was, I don't know, I can tell you that. So he got the news about it. It was Erev Yom Kippur, before he went to shul. This is true. So, and he knew in Russia, bribed. Worked wonders. Still a good thing. It worked. What wonders of Russia? The Jews couldn't survive. All the persecution in Russia, if you didn't have this magical, how to say, fantasy of bribing the officials. So he thought that if he'll bribe the Ispravnik, Ispravnik was the head of police, and the Ispravnik will give testimony about the character of the boy was a nice boy, he might have been involved in that. So he'll save the boy. The trial was to take place, you keep a monarch in Warsaw. Right? It's a night, it's about 7 hours travel, 7-8 hours travel. So, but you needed at least 10,000 rubles, 10,000 rubles at a time, was a lot of money, it was in 1906. So he closed all shuls in Kippur, what in Kippur Eve meant in Brisk 50 years ago. So he closed all shuls. He opened only one shul, the so-called cold shul, the big shul. Told all Jews of Greece to come to that shul. No one knew for what purpose. All shuls in Greece, there were about 25 shuls, tremendous community. All shuls were closed. All Jews had to stream to that shul. He came to that shul for Kol Nidre, for the service. Everything was ready, and he went up and pulpit. He said, "Gentlemen, I want you to go home. Open your safes, not safes, your drawers. Take all the money you need, you have. Bring the money to shul. We would not say Kol Nidre tonight, we'll collect money." mean, the people thought that the rabbi is out of his mind. He was out of his mind. I mean, you know what it meant 50 years ago in Brisk, and people from Lille tell people to go home and handle money and carry money. It's a true story. I mean, I'm not adding one word. I mean, I don't know how you know about it. How did you get...
I thought
my father was present there. So, and he and the members of the rabbinate of Brisk, was a great community, were on top of the platform, instead of saying from Lille, everybody, but since the rabbi said, I mean, this is an order. I mean, well, the rabbi is crazy in his right senses, so a different problem, but an order, even from a crazy rabbi, is an order. So it was carried out. It was carried out, and the people began to bring money. So in no time, the amount of $10,000 was raised. So instead of saying from Lille, he told the people to wait at the service, and he, with a group of prominent laymen of the community, went to the so-called Spravnik, the police commissioner of this, and they talked to him, and they gave him, I don't know how they gave him, this is a different story, skillfully gave him the money, and the Spravnik, the commissioner of police, asked my grandfather to sign an affidavit on behalf of this boy, to sign Yom Kippur an affidavit, you know, the night of Yom Kippur. My father signed affidavit, right, my grandfather signed affidavit right away. The Spravnik took the train the same night. He came to Warsaw morning to the trial, and as a Russian police commissioner, he testified that he's convinced in the innocence of the boy, and he was acquitted. Yeah, what does it show? It shows all the greatness and part of my grandfather, yes. I mean, I'll come and I'll speak about loving kindness, Dhaka. I have many stories like that. But what does it show? I mean, with regard to that.
But even in that instance, though.
He felt collectively responsible, of course. It's collective responsibility. Collective responsibility. Collective responsibility. It's not only that he felt if the boy had been found guilty, the guilt would be shared by the community, but there were two reasons. First of all, the sharing of, because if the boy had been found guilty, the guilt would have been shared by the community. Secondly, simply an act of mercy and sympathy and compassion to the boy. It's yes. And it's actually, I mean, the idea of collective moral accountability is mentioned in the Bible. You know, I'm a rabbi, I go back to the Bible. He's mentioned the Bible. If you open the Bible, Number 16, just a moment. Yes, number 16, verse 22. Verse 21, 20, 21, 22. Number 16, verse 20, 21, 22. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, separate yourself from the among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. They sing. It was the story with Korah. And they fell upon their faces and said, for God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation? It was a question mark. O ish echad yechate, one man sin, and your wrath will avenge itself upon the whole congregation? It's a question mark. And God did not say no, apparently it's the fact. It's more a rhetorical question. This is already collective responsibility. One was involved, the community paid the price. And of course, the Jewish law, yes, just a minute, the Jewish law of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh, every Jew halakhically is responsible for the commitments of his other fellow man. Yes. And what do you, I'm
asking,
Dr. Eisenberg.
I want to ask you a big question, Father, this charisma, this idea of covenant,
yes,
and it's an experience.
Sure.
From childhood on.
It's implanted, yes. I'll tell you, Dr. Eisenberg, you as an educator are interested in this problem. I'm also interested. We'll come to this problem, how practically to develop it. But let us limit ourselves now to theory. Of course, I know you're interested in that. I mean, as a Yeah, this is the idea of collective responsibility for individual culpability. It reflects unfavorably upon the community as such. They may be blamed for the errors of the one. They share the blame, which logically should be confined to the evildoer. It's a strange form of ethical solidarity comes to the fore. That is why our sages said, and it's important for modern Jews very much, that the Jew involved in a public scandal or in any transgression or in any indecent deed or something, and not only when this particular deed is morally culpable, morally or juridically culpable, when there is no element of culpability. You know, there are many things you do. We are on the line, as we say, of course, on the line, you know. But many things you do, I told once a lawyer in Boston. He says he's on the line. I said, yes, on the line, but you can do many things which are, although, I mean, you can't put one in jail for that, but they are very, I wouldn't even say they're immoral. They're even more, judged by formal standards, they are moral too. But it's still, I didn't know any adjective how to describe it, but it don't belong into, a Jew should not practice that. Something one is vulgar. Vulgarity is not immoral, no? I mean, there is no injunction against vulgarity. There is no injunction against bad manners. One can display bad manners in the streetcar or in a restaurant or on the street. I mean, there is no moral norm against exhibitionism. When Jews begin to exhibit their wealth or whatever they are, whatever they have, they possess, and their paintings or their jewelry or their mink coats. I mean, of course, mink coats are only women. I mean, men, I don't know what men exhibit. Oh, and there's something else. I mean, there is no moral law, but it's vulgar. Is even anything public in public vulgar or insolence, arrogance on the part of the Jew? Even though no moral wrong had been committed, if the Jew had perpetrated a double crime. First of all, if the act is culpable, it's bad in itself. And secondly, the crime reflects unfavorably upon the Jewish community. That's exactly what we call in the halacha, chilul Hashem. And on the contrary, if a Jew reflects credit upon the Jewish community, that's what we call Kiddush Hashem. This is a central norm. If you'll open the books, you'll find this norm. Leviticus 22. Leviticus 22, verse 32. And ye shall keep my commandments. Leviticus 22, verse 32. And you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. And you shall not profane my holy name. But I will be hallowed or sanctified among the children of Israel. How can one sanctify God? By not reflecting this word upon the Jewish people. God and the community are one. You are right. There is an element of risk there. You're right. But about tolerance, I mean, a different problem. I'll come to tolerance yet. But there is a... basically, I mean, we don't preach. We try to educate. I mean, of course, there is an element because I am personally involved. So I get angry. For instance, there are within the Jewish society, you'll take, for instance, certain groups. I don't want to mention names. We are more on the fringe. I mean, the fringe, they are easily scared by a public scandal about a Jew. So they sometimes engage in certain absurd, I would say, campaigns, which actually, I mean, are not constructive. But let's first, I mean, just describe it. And Maimonides says, and I'm ready for this, there are other things that are a profanation of the name of God. See, Maimonides says it. I'm quoting. When a man does things which cause people to talk about him, even if the acts do not express violations, he profanes the name of the God. As for example, if a person makes a purchase and does not pay promptly, provided that he has the means and the creditors ask for the payment, and we put them off. But there is no moral culpability in that. Or if he indulges immoderately in jesting, eating, or drinking, or when his mode of addressing people is not gentle, or he does not receive people affably, but he is quarrelsome and irritable. The greater the man is, the more scrupulous should he be in all such things, and do more than the strict letter of the law requires. If a man has been scrupulous in his conduct, gentle in his conversation, pleasant toward his fellow men, affable in manner when receiving them, not retorting even when affronted, but showing courtesy to all, conducting his commercial affairs with integrity, devoting himself to the study of the Torah and doing more than his duty in all things, avoiding extremes and exaggerations, such a man has sanctified God. And concerning him, the scripture says, "And he said unto me, Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I take pride, and by whom I am glorified." This is my mind. This is collective responsibility, gentlemen. If you want the source, I can give you. It is Deoth, D-E-O-T-H, 49, column 3. 49, chapter 49, paragraph 3. Yes. In a word, a Jew must always be conscious of his moral responsibility toward his fellow man. Fellow Jew, the guilt of an individual is also shared collectively, and others are accountable for his deeds, which reflect either credit or disgrace upon his people. This is moral togetherness, and this is very important. This is him together. But responsibility expresses itself in something else. And here I come to the concept of tzedakah. This is the moral covenant. Yes, sir. What do you call unpopular causes? Sometimes unpopular cause is a very good cause. I'll tell you frankly, it does not mean that I have to follow the line laid down by the daily news and the Daily Mirror. I don't mean it. Oh, no. I spoke about prophetic load. We'll come to concepts of social justice later, what the covenant requires of us in our dealings with outside society. Oh, no. A Jew, Abraham, was one Jew. I mean, the whole world was against him. But what's objectively wrong? I'm not speaking of it. There is a criterion in it. I'll give you an example. I had a case during this McCarthy period, this crazy McCarthy period. Some teacher, he was a teacher of French in a high school. He was a student at the Yeshiva University. So he was called before the Un-American Committee, the State Committee, and Un-American Activities, I mean, of course, and the chairman of the American, the chairman of the State Education Committee is a Jew now, Silver. Oh, yeah. Who is in servitude to the, I may say publicly in servitude to the Archbishop of Spelman, you see. He does what Spelman wants him to do. You see, I had my experience with him. So he was called, of course, McCarthy, I mean, he was a communist, they discovered in the 30s. And when I'll come to the concept of tshuva, of conversion, repentance, so McCarthy did not have the concept of tshuva. Anyway, and they wanted him to disclose the names of his associates. And there were teachers, actually, are teachers in the public school system. You know. So instead of quoting the Fifth Amendment, which is the usual procedure, he said that the Jewish law prohibits squealing in public. And he is a Jew who is committed to a set of moral principles. And he cannot violate them. So the American Jewish Committee got scared. They are easily scared. So I don't want to tell you the names, but the attorney of the American Jewish Committee called me, it's a public scandal. What's the public scandal? So he told me the story. The whole Jewish community is involved. You know what the paper will come out, Judaism protects, Jewish religion protects communism. So I said to him, I'll tell you, Mr. So-and-so, listen, you want me to give you an answer? I'll give it in writing, and I don't care if this answer will be published in the press. You just address your inquiry to the law commission of the Rabbinic Council of America, for which I am the chairman, and then it will be my duty, I mean, to answer. If no official inquiry is addressed to me, I'm not supposed to answer. So a letter came in, as a matter of fact, came in from the chairman of the commission. I don't remember his name now, a gentle fellow. And then it was turned over to me, and he had a fight at the Rabbinic Council of America. Most rabbis said, we cannot now, in such a climate of prejudice and hatred and bigotry, we cannot defend an individual who does not want to disclose the names of his associates. And you saw, I mean, it's very easy to become patriotic and employ, I mean, pseudo-patriotism. They are a menace to society. The man teaches French, the menace to society. And the other teacher about whom he was supposed to school taught physics, you see, a menace to society. And he quit the Communist Party, I mean, in the 30s. This was in the 40s. I was about 1950 or 1951. I don't remember exactly my memory. That's something. So finally, I wrote a brief. They never published this brief. And I said, I prohibit. He's a member of the Rabbinical Council. We made him a member of the Rabbinical Council of America. He joined, I mean, a few months ago. Whether he joined it because he knew it's coming up, I don't know. He was actually ordained. And he's a member of the Rabbinical Council of America, and he's subject to decisions of the law commission. I prohibit. I enjoin him from my decision from disclosing any names. And then they asked, and then I said, why? Because first of all, squealing is prohibited. We have to inform the authorities if the person in question is a public menace. But however, I don't see any public menace. Even if an associate who teaches physics or chemistry, biochemistry, I mean, was a member of the Communist Party 10 years before and quit because he didn't like the policies, because he simply has contempt for them now. And then the trouble is with all these inquiries that you don't know a basic law in the Bible, the law of repentance. Men can sin and come back to God. And that's why I don't dare tell him, I mean, to inform. And they took the letter, and he was not cited for contempt. The letter was not published by anybody. I don't know where it is now, probably the family file somewhere. I mean, I don't say that, but I mean culpability at a higher level. Now, collective responsibility, gentlemen, manifest itself also at the level of tzedakah. What is the idea of tzedakah? You know what tzedakah means in Jewish life, in Jewish law. What is it? Why is it so much important? People say because Jews are good. I don't know whether the Jews by nature are tender. I don't know. I have still questions. It's very simple. Since compassion in total involvement in the destiny of the Dao, at all levels, at intellectual level, at the emotional level, at the moral culpability, level of moral culpability, is the first aspect of the Am covenant. This existential identification expresses itself in halakhic terms of tzedakah. I must extend assistance to my brother who is in need and cannot help himself. I must share the burden which unfriendly circumstances placed upon his frail shoulders and help him carry this burden. There is something very interesting about tzedakah, which I want you to understand. Basically, what's the equivalent in English? Not in English, it's in Latin. What's the equivalent in Latin, which was anglicized and incorporated into our English vernacular for tzedakah? What is it? Charity. It comes from the Latin caritas. What caritas means is love. That's basically what the Greek agape means, love, deep love. Very deep love, profound love, yes, love. Love expressed in deeds, that's what it means. Love expressed in deeds. But basically this translation is very wrong. And I'll explain you why. This translation distorts the whole concept of tzedakah. Caritas, in Latin, is rather the equivalent for the Hebrew term of chesed. Chesed, you know, means loving kindness. This is basically caritas is the equivalent, means loving kindness. It's almost, semantically, it's almost the most exact translation of loving kindness. While tzedakah, whoever knows Hebrew, tzedakah and tzedek are the same words. And what does tzedek mean in Hebrew? Justitia. Justice, righteousness. Why the hey was added to a different problem? What is tzedek and tzedakah the same? why this noun was heavy, has the feminine form, is a problem. It's a problem. My mind is trying to solve this problem. What it means, it's justitia. It is justice, righteousness. Let us see, what's the difference between caritas, philosophically? What's the difference between caritas and justitia? They're both Latin terms, justitia and caritas. Or between charity, loving kindness, and righteousness, justice. There is one difference. Justitia is a juridic idea. It's a legalistic term. Caritas is not a legalistic term, not a juridic term. Caritas is a moral term. Law doesn't know anything about caritas. Even in courts of equity, there is no caritas. Equity is also based on justitia. What are the two kinds of justitia? The plain, simple justitia, you loan money, you have to pay, and there is equity, a higher form of justitia. But even courts of equity have nothing to do with caritas. A court cannot decree caritas, cannot tell me what to do. Because caritas itself, basically, means voluntary, free, non-uncommitted, self-imposed, flowing out of a free choice. Law, you can't compel one to give you law. You can compel him to live according to the law, but not to give you love. If he refuses to give love, it's no way to compel. Not even a husband can compel his wife. Not even a father can compel his children to give him love. So caritas is of course, law is a moral value. Justice is not only a moral value, it's a juridic value. It's a juridic concept. You understand? The ethos, caritas is a question of the ethos. Justice is a concept of the law, of the law and order. If you'll take my monitors, just one moment, I want to time. My monitors in the last chapter, I cannot read it completely because it needs more. Chapter 65, last section, third section. He says, my monitors, not 65, excuse me, not 65, but 59. No, 53, part 3. He says, chesed denoting an excess. It is especially used of extraordinary kindness, loving kindness to those who have no claim whatever upon us. This is my mind's definition. Third section, chapter 53. Who have no claim whatever upon us. Now, tzedek, the term tzedaka, derived from tzedek, means righteousness. It denotes the act of giving everyone his due and of showing kindness to every being according as he deserves. This is law. He always demands give the other fellow what is due to him. Morality demands from us give every fellow what is not, even what is not due. So now, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, so the term tzedakah, if we translate it with caritas, what does it mean? What does it mean, gentlemen? Ladies and gentlemen, what does it mean? If it is caritas, then it means so. It's an act of loving kindness. You see, the man, for instance, it's interesting. The man, for instance, who gives tzedakah, what do you call baal tzedakah? Baal tzedakah. What does it mean? Baal tzedakah means a man of justice. Right? In English, what will you say? How will you say? You'll use the Greek equivalent of philanthrop. What does it mean? Philanthrop means a lover of people. It's love. You see, however you maneuver, then you want to express the idea of tzedakah in English, you take refuge, so to say, in the Greek Roman worldview. They didn't know anything of charity. I mean, I'll use tzedakah. I should give him, I owe anything to the poor man, I don't owe him anything. The Greek, with their disdain, with their supercilious attitude to our the poor classes, with their disdainful approach, I owe him, I owe something to the slave, I don't owe anything. If I'm a philanthrop, a lover of people, it's a luxury, basically. Of course, I can be very generous. That's all. Very generous. Basically, If you study Greek history or Roman history, you wouldn't find a single incident of this doctor. They don't know anything. Dakar was not enumerated among the virtues formulated by Plato and Aristotle. They don't know anything about Dakar. Charity? No. All right, it's a luxury. One likes the arts and sculpture, not all one likes to play around with human beings and shower love upon them. No, for instance, because of that, no system, no Western system of no system of law in Western society has ever said that Dakar, the charity, can be collected, compulsorily collected from people. That you can sit down, assess a man, his financial circumstances, fix an amount which he's supposed to give, must give, according to financial report, and collect the amount from him. I mean, if such a bill should be introduced in Congress, or in any legislature or general assembly, in any of the 48 states, people would say the senator or the Congress or the member of the House who introduces such legislation that is not in his right senses. Because the basic idea of charity means freedom. Because it is not a juridic category. It's not a juridic norm. For instance, thou shalt not steal is a juridic norm. But thou shalt help the poor is not a juridic norm. It's a moral norm. Morality, what's the difference between law and morality? Law is enforceable, morality is enforceable. You cannot enforce morality. Morality is the element of freedom. While the moral norm can be enforced, a man can be compelled to comply with the moral norm. Yeah, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt pay your debts, and so forth. This is exactly what is the Roman Greek concept. It was adopted by Western society.
It is. I'm just wondering about in contemporary times, this whole struggle in the Supreme Court in terms of the segregation, in some respects, reflects what I would think a kind of moral law as well as a legalistic law.
A legalistic law because the Constitution, as it was enacted, since I mean equality is a constitutional term, so it becomes law. I mean, but now the new concept of tzedakah, which is alien completely to any system of law adopted by civilized society, is different. The Jewish law says that tzedakah is a juridic term. And tzedakah, you know what it was? This is the law and this was the practice throughout the generations. There was assessment. Like now there was assessment of taxes, there was assessment from tzedakah. Bedin, or whoever it is, the community or the court, used to sit down, appraise objectively the circumstances of a member of the community, assessing not only his taxes, in regard to taxes. This was a different assessment. How much tzedakah he must give. What difference it is, whatever it is. Whatever it is, self-government. Of course, if we have no self-government, we couldn't assess. Because in the Middle Ages we had self-government, in Babylonia we had self-government. But it goes back to the Second Commonwealth, as a matter of fact. They used to assess individuals, and the individual refused to pay, so they used simply take away his property, sell it, the method of foreclosure, and collect the amount which was fixed and raised upon this particular individual. And the famous statement in Baba Batra, with which Maimonides quotes it in his famous chapter on tzedakah, Memashkenin al tzedakah, you can sell property in order to collect tzedakah, which was assessed and fixed, with regard to one individual, afilu ba'arvei Shabbatot, even on Friday afternoon, when all courts are closed. So you open the court for this session, for this particular act, you give an edict of collection, what do you call it, and you collect tzedakah. Why is it so? It's strange. Why is it so? Why is it so? Because tzedakah depends upon our experience, upon the existential community, the awareness of togetherness, which manifests itself in social responsibility, in sympathy, requiring welfare action. It places a duty, not a moral duty, but a legalistic duty, a juridic duty. This is not an act of charity, of compliance, but an act of compliance with a legal duty enforced. possible by the thoughts. This goes back to the covenant in Egypt. Am together. Basically, it means that our property rights are not parochial. They are community property rights. But otherwise, that the poor man has a right to my property, and if I refuse to give him his share, it is a violation in contravention of a juridic norm, of the law. Like as if I had loaned money and refused to pay the creditor. This is basically the community of responsibilities. It finally results in a community of property. Of course, the community of property had to be restricted, but this is basically private property is non-existent. I'll come to it later. First of all Jews may share your property. Of course, the Jew needs, if there's no need, I must. And of course, sharing does not mean by unilateral action on the part of the poor should just come into the house and take away. It must be enforced. It must have, so to say, it must employ legal procedure. But this legal procedure, I think a poor man can come, according to the law, it's a funny law. A poor man can come in the city and say, this man is rich. And I am starving. I want him to support me. The court, with upon request, would assess possibilities, of course. Inquire, assess possibility, whether the man can make a living. And the court should find out that this poor man cannot make a living. He's helpless. And he's the only one who can support him. There's no one else in the community. So court can write an edict of collection. And by writing an edict of collection, it means it becomes a debt. This is the Jewish law. This is halacha. This is not my philosophy, my experience. And this is based upon the covenant of Am, together at all levels, at the level of destiny, interests, feelings, experiences, moral responsibilities, and welfare responsibilities, and finally, together in property, in ownership. All right?
To what really was the first of all these lectures, and this lecture will be cut up in the middle, beginning on the 6th of November, 1958.
Well, just give me a little water, Alice. I don't know, I'm a newcomer here, and I'd like to know, what is it? Is it a lecture or a seminar? I would like to understand it better. If you could explain it to me. It's more of a symposium, a discussion, or it's a straight lecture. it depends upon you, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. It's the same to me. Same to me. It's a combination. So I would perhaps make a compromise that I would lecture, but you have a right, and I would rather appreciate if you would interrupt my lecture in case you have a question to ask. This is my policy. I have been a teacher for many, many years. My policy is that the students interrupt me if they want to ask me a question. So I would appreciate if you should interrupt me and something is not clear, or you have a question, or if you disagree with me. Yes. This is not a loudspeaker. I thought it's a loudspeaker. If you, there's no loudspeaker here. So anyway.
Would it be easier for you to sit in the middle of the room?
I believe it would be much better.
Excuse me a minute.
Philosophy of religion. Philosophy of religion at many levels. Means modern philosophy of religion, comparative philosophy of religion, medieval philosophers, Jewish and Christian, and so forth and so on. My training basically was not in the field of philosophy of religion, but the philosophy of science, Kantian, neo-Kantian philosophy. So perhaps I have a strange approach to philosophy of religion, because my training was not a theological one or exclusively in the field of philosophy, religion, and religious thought. However, I've been, so to say, cast in or thrust in, using an expression by Heidegger, into a certain environment where philosophy of religion was considered important. So I tried to interpret, I mean, Jewish religious concept in philosophical terms. To tell you that I know much about it, I would not be sincere. Basically, I am very perplexed, and perhaps as perplexed as anybody else and more. And I don't believe that Judaism is a philosophy, is a religion which has many answers, like the Catholic philosophy. Judaism has many problems, but very few answers. Very few answers. And perhaps the more I lecture, the more perplexed you will be, and the more I'll confuse you instead of clearing up some problems in your mind. And however, but it's good if you can see a problem and to understand the problem is insoluble. And actually, I mean, my mind says that to be perplexed does not mean to be confused. And whatever I'll say, I'm not laying claim to any theoretical or cognitive validity. I don't know whether what I'm going to say is true or not. It's hard to say. We don't have criteria by which objectively to judge our opinions about Judaism. We have no laboratory, we have no tests. The empirical approach we have, is as developed as in the field of positive sciences. All I'll say to you is just my own subjective thoughts and feelings about Judaism. I have tried to interpret Judaism in modern terms. I mean, for the Jew in his encounter with the modern world, I've tried very hard. But it's only a subjective experience and a subjective interpretation on my part. I'm not out to convert anybody. I'm not carrying the gospel of Judaism. I lack missionary zeal. Whatever I'll do, take it as an act of confidence on my part, as confessing, or rather letting you share my own subjective experience, my own private experience. If you should find that my experience and there is some commensurability between your feelings and my experience, my efforts will be rewarded. However, if you should find that my experience and your experience are incommensurable, incongruous, then you will disagree with me totally, I will not feel hurt. But it's very hard, I mean, to find commensurability between private experiences of individuals. So the trait of uniqueness actually precludes commensurability. In general, whoever speaks about Judaism or makes an authoritative statement, I don't believe, I'm not saying about Jewish law, but about Jewish philosophy, is wrong. Just a subjective interpretation. We have no authority to determine which philosophy is, let's say, the perennial Jewish philosophy, and which one is just a modern, ancient interpretation of Judaism. Now, I believe that the topic of our lectures would deal with man and his social institutions he created. But today I wouldn't speak about men. I'll just give an introduction as to the methodology of Judaism and how you can approach this problem. Judaism has a doctrine of man. Because if it has no doctrine of man, so it could get up and go home. As a matter of fact, such a doctrine underlies every civilized religion. Any civilized religion, not only Judaism, Christianity and Islam, must have a doctrine of man. Since religion is concerned with the relationship, with the triple relationship of God, man, and the world, this is the basic relationship in any philosophy of religion, it must necessarily possess some knowledge, on the one hand, of God's infinite will, which conveys to man the moral law, and the means by which this moral law is to be realized, and, on the other hand, of man himself, the subject of the good religious conduct and the ethical norm. And now, let me add something. Cognition, or knowledge, is one of the main motives which determine and shape the religious experience. The homo religiosus, I mean, it's a technical term, it means the man of religious experience. The homo religiosus is engaged in a cognitive gesture. He's basically a theoretical man, a homo theoreticus, or anthropos theoreticus. The intellectual urge is as potent in him as it is in the homo theoreticus. Curiosity prompts both the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus to face the world and men in an inquisitive mood of inquiring. I am saying that because many theories in the history of philosophy of religion have maintained that religion is not a cognitive gesture. It's either, as Schleiermacher wanted us to believe, an emotional gesture. And the main, so to say, the main experience of the homo religiosus can be reduced to the feeling of absolute dependence, or as Kant and the Neo-Kantian school maintained, the religious experience is an ethical one, the moral experience, the experience of the absolute imperative. So Schleiermacher sentimentalized religion, Kant ethicized religion. Both of them have eliminated the intellectual urge of the homo religiosus. The homo religiosus doesn't want to know, but he wants to act. That's what counts. Schleiermacher said, the homo religiosus doesn't want to know, nor does he want to act. He feels something. He is emotionally unique. However, intellectually, volitionally, ethically, morally, there is no unique. No singularity. However, it's impossible to maintain this attitude, particularly in modern religion. The religious experience has basic, central, intellectual, or cognitive motifs, like the homo theoreticus. Whoever he is, scientist, psychologist, philosopher, the religious person is a person who seeks knowledge. Of course, the objectives and hence the methods of the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus are different. They vary. The homo theoreticus studies a reality bounded in by finite